All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated, please.
Good morning. The court has two matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 080121, City of Waco versus Deborah Kerwan, individually and as representative of the estate of Brad McGehee, deceased, from McLennan County and the 10th Court of Appeals District. And docket number 080272, Dealers Electrical Supply Company versus Scoggins Construction Company, Inc., and Bill R. Scoggins from Hidalgo County and the 13th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each argument, and we will take a brief recess between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 080121, City of Waco versus Deborah Kerwan.
Court, Mr. Olson will present argument for the petitioner. Mr. Morales will present argument for the state of Texas. Mr. Olson will open with the first 10 minutes. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, good morning. In this court's opinion in the case of State versus Shoemake, the court found that Chapter 75 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code permits a premises defect claim for gross negligence under certain conditions. In the court's opinion, the court, after saying that, the court said it's important to understand what those conditions are. And as we read it, in four short sentences, set out a framework from which practitioners and those in the public can understand the court's ruling and how the recreational use statute should apply. The court started with natural conditions, inherent dangers of nature, acknowledging Justice Brister's concerns in his dissent regarding the complications that could be brought about by requiring any landowner to warn of every inherent danger of nature. The court wrote, contrary to the dissent's suggestion, we do not hold or even imply that a landowner may be grossly negligent for failing to warn of the inherent dangers of nature. We believe that forms step one of the framework to be looked at when determining whether or not a duty is owed as it relates to a premises condition in a recreational setting. Step two, the next concept dealt with was that of being open and obvious. And the court said that if it's an open and obvious condition, that there's no duty to warn. So now we've addressed natural conditions, open and obvious conditions. And here comes the third step as we see it, and that is the court said that a landowner can be liable for gross negligence in creating a condition that would a user would not expect to encounter. So the third step in the process as we see it is that if a landowner creates a condition that it knew posed an extreme degree of risk, indicating conscious indifference to the safety of others, that landowner could be liable. That is, a duty to warn arises out of the creation of the condition through gross negligence. In this case, the Kerwan case, the pleadings and the evidence before the court both clearly show that this is a natural condition. It's uncontroverted. Frankly, we believe that should have been the end of the analysis. As we understand Shoemake, this is a natural condition. The court has said that the court is not holding nor even implying that there is any duty to warn as it relates to a natural condition. The Court of Appeals disagreed with that. In dealing with this, rather than saying this is a natural condition, there is no duty to warn, one cannot be grossly negligent for failing to warn of an inherent danger of nature. Instead, the Court of Appeals drew the conclusion that the natural conditions to which this court referred to were only open and obvious natural conditions. And drawing that conclusion then moved on down line, and we'll talk in just a moment about the Court of Appeals analysis.
Mr. Olson, I gather from your argument that you believe Shoemake would have come out the other way if the man-made culvert that caused the condition that sucked the little girl under water and caused her to drown, which had happened several times before that and the state was aware of it, if that man-made culvert had, however, been a naturally occurring underground tunnel that caused the same effect in the water, do you believe Shoemake would have come out the other way?
I do. And in fact, the court's example of a rushing river as an example of an inherent danger of nature, which people should, appreciate, would include that. I think the example of the rushing river includes not just topographically, there goes the river, but snags in the river, whirlpools under the river, undertows under the river, shoals under the river, sandbars, and all that sort of thing.
And if four little girls had drowned the day before in the Shoemake circumstance with a naturally occurring underwater tunnel, then even the little girl drowning the next day, because it was a natural tunnel, not a man-made culvert, Shoemake would have come out.
I believe that's what this court said. Yes, sir.
What if the city or the state has an expert report saying this natural structure is very likely to collapse within the next week, and the park ranger says, yes, go camp there, that's fine. No duty there?
Well, we have two different things possibly there, Your Honor. One is the naturally occurring condition. And again, I think Shoemake is clear that naturally occurring conditions, there is no duty to warn, and one cannot be grossly negligent for failing to warn. Now, what someone says about it may be something different than just the condition itself. We may have a negligent activity rather than just a premises.
Well, that wouldn't be an activity. I'm the park ranger. I know from an expert report that is sound that this structure is very likely to collapse, the rock wall that we're talking about here. And someone comes and asks me, where should I camp or where should I go to watch the boat races? And I, knowing about the condition, I say, right there.
Well, if it rises to the level of intent, we'd look at another issue under the Tort Claims Act. But if it's arising out of a natural condition, I believe this court said that if it arises out of a natural condition, there would be no duty to warn. One could not be grossly negligent for that.
What's the public policy behind such a bright line rule? For example, if you have a ski area that's subject to avalanches, that's naturally occurring, but don't you want to warn people? Or if you've got a public beach where there have been 10 shark attacks or undertows, don't you want a sign that warns people?
Well, I would say, although it's discussed some, I think, in your opinion, in Shoemake, the policy issue is the breadth and width of potential dangers and the possibility of warning about every possible danger of nature. That is what I took from your opinion, from the court's opinion in Shoemake, is the breadth of that. It would be... I just don't know how it would be possible. In a place like Waco, at Cameron Park, where there's, you know, it's one of the largest parks inside a city in the United States. And, you know, if we begin a list of every possible serious complication that would come from the nature there.
But there's a spectrum. And shouldn't we, if there's a known high probability of danger that has occurred and is likely to recur, even if it's a naturally occurring condition, at what point in that spectrum? I mean, we can all imagine both ends of that spectrum, and where in the line should we draw some duty if it's something that happens often, even though it's naturally occurring?
Well, I think you've already drawn that line. That would be my statement to you in the Shoemake case. If we start from the proposition that a trespasser owes no duty to warn, in common law, a landowner owes no duty to warn a trespasser of a premises condition. That in and of itself has the same sort of complications as you have just laid out there. But if the statute says that, fiction or not, that those coming on to a piece of property for recreational purposes are owed no duty greater than that of a trespasser, then I think what the court has already done in Shoemake is frankly moved beyond what I would consider to be the traditional notions of what a trespasser should be warned about.
What would it do to the park if the city had to put up rails, walls, or fences to make sure that nobody could get to the edge of the cliffs?
It wouldn't be a park, Judge.
And how much would that cost?
Well, I don't know. I represent a lot of cities
over
a lot of time.
We could make it safe, I assume, but it wouldn't be much of a park.
Well, it would be something to look at through the fence, I guess. You're right.
There are barriers at the Grand Canyon. Does that make it any less of a park?
Well, not within the record, but the barriers aren't much. And
there's signs there?
There's signs? No, sure. Sure, there are barriers. There's signs at Cameron Park. There's signs at Circle Point here.
And when I went to the Grand Canyon, the ranger told us that of the 100 or so people that had fallen off the edge, every one of them had fallen off at a place where there were rails. Because, of course, what people do when there are rails is you walk up, stand on them, and look over. Whereas when there's no rails, you stay back from them. Do we make, in fact, the park more dangerous if we encourage people to go up to the edge and look off by putting rails there?
I don't know that I'm qualified to say that it's more dangerous, but I would say this. I don't know to what extreme measures one would have to go in Waco, Texas, not to mention Big Bend State Park or Guadalupe Mountains or on the beach, to protect against every possibly, arguably, known natural dangerous condition.
Does it change? Report requisition. Why was the study by this student sought?
It wasn't. It's a misnomer to call it a report because it was a student term paper. Like some kids in class at Baylor had a project, and one of them was to look at the rocks on the ground along the bottom of this line of cliffs in Waco, and where they're openly and obviously a big pile of rocks, they'd look up and try to opine as to why the rocks fell. The fact of the falling of the rocks, the danger posed by rocks falling, there wasn't but one place they could come from. Brazos River is on your right, and river bottom as far as the eye can see. On the left, a sheer cliff of fractured hundreds of thousands of year old limestone rock. If rocks are in the piles on the ground, the young people would stop and then look up and say, well, based on our opinion, this is why they fell. But it wasn't sought, and in fact, it was sent gratuitously to the city and put in a file.
There's a question here. Thank you, counsel. The court will hear from the amicus, State of Texas.
May it please the court. If left uncorrected, the opinion of the Court of Appeals below would improperly subject the state, cities, and municipalities to liability for injuries caused by the myriad inherent natural conditions and dangers that exist in the hundreds of thousands of acres of state land.
Let me ask you a question that I was going to ask Mr. Olson. The property owner in this case, the city or the state, whatever the park might be, in many cases will undertake a duty, putting up signs, putting on railings around the rim. Does that change the dynamics here at all?
No, it doesn't change the duty that is owed to the statutory trespasser in this case.
But you put up signs.
Yes.
And you do, as Justice Brister pointed out, you could change people's behavior by the use of the signs. That's what signs are for, aren't they?
Yes, that is one use. And that is a policy decision that is undertaken by the governmental body. And right now, under Shoemake, if it's properly interpreted, unlike what the Court of Appeals did below, governmental bodies such as the city and the state are free to exercise those discretionary policy decisions, whether to put a sign up, whether not to put a sign up, what to put on the sign. One of the issues that I wanted to talk about today was the discretionary duty exception in the Tort Claims Act. That is one issue that got pushed aside. It's been briefed in our amicus as well as in the city's brief as well as in the Texas Municipal League's brief. But it is an extremely important one to the state. And I'll jump to that, if you will, Justice Green, since that is an issue that probably will not get around to.
Let me just ask one quick question before you do. Let me take the chief's example just one step further. If the risk were certain to occur if encountered, something like quicksand or something, where we've been talking about risks that might occur if you encountered them, or the rocks might fall, the object might collapse. But what if the danger is there and there's no question if you walk into it, you're going to be hurt? Does that make any difference?
No, it does not, if it's a natural condition. Now, in practical terms, the state, the city, municipalities want people to come onto their lands for recreational use. That's the purpose and the policy behind the recreational use statute. It does the state and the city no good to have people dying in their parks. That's not the goal. What this is about is liability. Whether or not the city or the state owns that land on which the quicksand lies, someone coming along, depending, it doesn't matter who owns it, the forces of nature would cause that quicksand to be there, and any person, any animal, anybody that's coming across would probably suffer their demise. That would happen in any event. And the purpose behind, and I'll go to Justice Brister's comments both in Miranda as well as in Shoemake, we take nature as it comes. Part of the beauty and the reason behind the recreational use statute is to encourage landowners, not just the state, but all landowners, to provide their land for the public benefit. If we're putting up signs, if we're warning for every natural condition, then that purpose would be thwarted.
Council, let me now, there's good policy arguments. Folks are going to argue both ways. We're interpreting a statute here, recreational use statute. Where does natural condition occur in that statute?
There is not. It's not distinguished in the text.
In the statute at all?
Yes, in the definitions, it talks about natural conditions. It does have a list of different premises that would constitute this. So, yes.
Vision talking about liability to a trespasser says there's none except for willful or wanton acts or gross negligence by the owner, lessee, or occupant of the land. How do we get to natural conditions?
We get to natural conditions through the trespasser standard and the common law. And as it as this court held in Miranda and later in Shoemake, you talked about the duty that is owed to that trespasser. And clearly, this court definitively said there is no duty to warn about inherent natural conditions. If I could, because I see my time is, well, my time is up, if I could complete my thought.
You may complete the thought you have started.
My quick thought. My quick statement, because I know it's going to come up from the respondent, is that the argument has been made that this is an isolated incident, that this is not going to come up. It's very it's in the very minor circumstances where there's a report or some students got together and provided this information. And for the vast majority of cases, the state will not be liable, and this is not going to be a slippery slope type occurrence.
It seems to create a whole entire avenue of litigation.
Yes. What it would do, it would create a whole new avenue of litigation concerning the adequacy of signs, for one.
And whether or not they have to be in English, Vietnamese, or Swahili.
Well, that's exactly right, because you take if the goal is for the plaintiff to know, to understand the danger, well, how in the world could they understand it if they don't speak English or the like? What's going to happen is we're going to have signs, not only littering the countryside with signs, but the signs are going to have to be huge. They're going to have to be huge because you're going to have to anticipate every single natural condition that might come up.
Well, again, there's a spectrum.
Yes.
You know, if there is no duty when nothing's ever occurred, but if you've got 15 drownings because of a naturally occurring condition over a course of time, it seems to me that's just a different scenario.
It is. And again, from a practical standpoint, what would happen on behalf of the city or the state or any governmental body is that they would take discretionary actions in that regard.
But they wouldn't have to.
They would not have to.
But they would show up at the city council or the parks board and they'd make some, a lot of demands.
Yes.
Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Singley will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. Good morning. This is an unusual combination of circumstances that we have in this case, and I believe an analogy might help frame the discussion and the natural risk that we have at issue. Let's suppose I'm in my office on the 16th floor and I've got my window open. And let's pose two scenarios starting from that point. In one of them, I'm clumsy and I stumble and fall out the window. And in the second scenario, the floor right by the window collapses out from beneath me in a 5-foot diameter chunk because the girders or supports are defective and have rotted away.
Well, that seems more like a premises defect claim. We're talking about nature being outside, so I can't even understand your analogy from that viewpoint. So once you give me a situation where you're standing outside and something bad happens to you, or what happens in a situation like Jacob's Well, which is a famous well in this area, many people have drowned in that well because you have to go through a chamber, take off your tanks, and I was out there 6 weeks ago. People still go diving there, and there is no science. So what duty would the state, because that's right in the middle of the Blanco River, so it should be on state property. What duties does the state have there?
I think the duty that the state has there, Your Honor, is the duty that was set forth in Shoemake, that there is a gross negligence duty for conditions that are not open and obvious. And neither the recreational use statute nor this court in Shoemake imposed any limitation that would exclude natural conditions. And I believe to do so would be directly against the core holding of Shoemake.
So should the state go and close all these natural underground caverns where divers go, just put semen in there so no one can enjoy them?
Certainly not, Your Honor. In those rare circumstances where we have a danger that's not open and obvious, but it's one that the state or the city knows about, the recreational use statute and Shoemake impose a duty, either a gross negligence duty only, either to warn or to make the conditions safe. And so, depending on the particular facts, the government has an array of choices about warning or making it safe that would be appropriate to the conditions.
But if somebody gets killed, isn't that some evidence in every case that it was not open and obvious?
I don't believe so.
I mean, unless, Your Honor, assume with me the person, there's no evidence the person was suicidal.
Yes.
Get killed, isn't that some evidence in every case that the danger was not open and obvious, because otherwise they wouldn't have gotten killed?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and I think highlighting the two different possible risks associated with a cliff is instructive here. One is clearly an open and obvious risk, as this court said in Shoemake. If you slip and fall off the edge of a cliff, that's an open and obvious risk, and everybody knows it. Here we have a very, very different risk. We have a 5-foot diameter chunk of rock that collapsed away due to a pervasive structural defect that was not obvious, and a captain and the firefighter said it was not obvious to the average person.
One, I agree with you, one's more obvious than the other, but doesn't everybody know rocks fall off of cliffs?
I think where
do cliffs come from?
At a certain level.
Where do little rocks come from? They fall off of bigger rocks.
And if we're talking
everybody knows that's what cliffs do.
I think at some level that's certainly true, Your Honor, not to the extent that we're dealing with here. There are loose pebbles on the edge of a cliff. I think everyone knows that small amounts of rock can break away. And if we had a situation here where Mr. McGee, he had slipped on loose pebbles, that'd be a completely different case.
But as Mr. Olson pointed out, the base of the cliff are these very large rocks, as you see in most rock cliffs. Isn't that some indicator that the rock fell off the edge of the cliff? I mean, it's not a matter of loose gravel. It's that big rocks fall off of cliffs as a natural state, natural condition.
I think not to the extent that a person standing at the top of the cliff, that it would be, as a matter of law, conclusively open and obvious that standing up there at the top of the cliff, a 5-foot diameter chunk of rock could fall away.
Let me ask you, didn't Mr. McGee cross the fence? And there was a fence, and there was a sign.
There's a low retaining wall, and there was a sign that said, "For your safety, do not go beyond this wall."
Why doesn't that answer the question? If he had heeded that warning, then we wouldn't be here today, correct?
That is true, Your Honor, and that doesn't answer the question because the duty is to provide an adequate warning. And this court has repeatedly held that an adequate warning needs to be one that identifies the risk at issue and also the severity of the risk.
Something like, dear moron, do not cross this thing because you're going to injure yourself? I mean, how specific do you need to be?
It depends on the circumstances. In this situation, Your Honor, perhaps something like danger, unstable rock, fatal hazard.
And he dies anyway, then the argument's going to be the warning wasn't good enough. It should have been a warning and a retention wall with glass so he can see through it and not go over the cliff. I mean, there's not ever going to be a warning adequately to warn people that for whatever reason, assume whatever risk that is they encounter when they try to get closer to the edge of a cliff, in this instance.
Your Honor, under this gross negligence duty, if we had a warning that identified the nature of the risk at issue here, we'd have a very different case. And I think this court has said in past cases that when a warning does identify the specific risk, you have a very different case than one that in which the risk is not identified.
In these underground caves where divers go in Texas, there should be a warning. You're saying there should be a warning. If you go in this cave, you risk drowning, enter at your own risk. And the state would have to go put all these signs because they certainly have knowledge of divers drowning in these underground caves.
They wouldn't if that condition is open and obvious, Your Honor. I'm not familiar enough with the situation.
It's not open and obvious. You got to get in the water. So it's never open and obvious unless you're a diver to see what's going down.
All right. Since I'm not familiar with the facts, I'm a bit handicapped. If we're just talking about the danger of potentially swimming and drowning from swimming, that would seem to be open and obvious. If there's a particular condition that's unexpected or unusual beyond being in water and drowning, and it's something that the government has actual knowledge of, Shoemake and the recreational use statute impose a duty to warn or make safe.
How could it be gross negligence if the city undertook to warn in the first place?
This court has held in a number of cases, I'm thinking of the Lee Lewis case and Mobile versus Ellender, that using some care does not defeat gross negligence as a matter of law. And again, we're on the summary judgment standard here. I think that Mobile versus Ellender case is very instructive, Your Honor. That was a benzene exposure case at a Mobile plant, in which Mobil was able to put on evidence that it had taken some precautions to protect its workers from benzene exposure, but it did not take all possible precautions. There was a challenge after the verdict to the gross negligence finding, and this court upheld it, saying the fact that some care was taken does not conclusively negate gross negligence as a matter of law.
In this case, counsel, you've acknowledged that if your client had heeded the warning, he wouldn't have died.
That's true.
So what about the argument that the city of Waco's actions were intended to and would have precluded the injury entirely if they were followed? So the argument would be that the city's actions were sufficient to have precluded this.
Right. And, Your Honor,
response to that?
The response is that this court, I believe, has previously held that just because a warning is not adequate and we don't have a matter of law situation if the warning does not identify the specific risk. I mean, someone looking at that sign could think, don't go beyond the wall. That could refer to the obvious risk of falling off the cliff. If a specific risk is mentioned, such as the unstable cliff rock that's hidden, then a person understands that something more than the obvious risk is at issue.
And but it's my understanding the report that was done by the student doesn't relate to this area. It's a different area entirely.
It relates to an area very near here. That's correct. The Circle Point area is not specifically mentioned, Your Honor. The Eamon's Cliff area, which is a similar limestone formation and is next to the Circle Point area, is specifically mentioned, as is another area over from that.
So you would say that once this report was written, that they had to go through the entire park and put a sign at every cliff to say danger, cliff could fall?
For any of the cliff formations that have the similar type of geologic structure and potential danger, yes, there would then be a duty either to warn or make safe, and whatever is the best way to do that.
It is a large park, isn't it?
It's a large park.
My recollection from my schoolboy days, it's one of the largest city parks around, correct?
It's a large park, that's correct, Your Honor.
And this is a big bunch of cliffs.
And there are a lot of cliffs. That's correct, Your Honor. One thing I want to
turn. Would they do testing by just observation, or would they have to bring an expert in to determine the geological structure of the rock?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. It seems like it might require some expert survey in order to determine which cliffs are subject to that same hazard and risk and which are not.
Well, who's going to pay for that? Taxpayers of
apparently so. I would think so if it's a city park, Your Honor.
What did the record say about Mr. McGeehee's awareness of the risk?
There's no direct evidence about Mr. McGeehee since he was alone and he died, so there's certainly nothing from him. The evidence we have about that comes from Captain Benjamin Samaripa, who was the City of Waco firefighter, the first responder who found his body. He'd been out in that same area many times on training and testified, and so he's very familiar with the area. He said he was not personally familiar that the rocks could collapse away in that fashion, and also in his lay opinion that the average park patron not be aware that the rocks could collapse like that. And so, again, on the summary judgment standard, if a City of Waco firefighter isn't aware and doesn't think people would be aware, that would raise a fact issue on the question of open and obviousness here. I'd like to turn back to the construction of Shoemake, if I may. And I believe the main problem with the city's argument here is that it runs directly contrary to the core holding of Shoemake. This court was very clear, as I read Shoemake, that the recreational use statute allows gross negligence claims without, under the traditional definition, without limitation, as long as, of course, they're not open and obvious. And as the opinion is written, I mean, obviously, the claim there was that there could only be concurrent negligent activity claims and not premises defect claims. And the rationale for rejecting that argument and holding that premises defect claims are allowed is that the statute supplants the common law, so common law notions of trespassers don't apply. The statute simply says gross negligence and does not impose any type of limitation on what type of gross negligence is actionable. And here, it's a different species of the same argument. The city is requesting a limitation on the type of gross negligence that's actionable here.
But, of course, our negligence standard in all cases, all kinds of cases, car wrecks, everything, is considering all the surrounding circumstances. So that what may be negligent on a busy highway may or may not be negligent on a city street or a rural highway. So you take everything. So when you're talking about parks, it is a little bit different from the parking lot at the city auditorium, because those by nature are supposed to be rough and wild and things like that, right?
I can absolutely see that there's a difference, and I think in many times there would be. And particularly under this gross negligence standard, one immediate example of that, Your Honor, is if you have a condition, an artificial condition or something that's created, a building, a structure, it's much more likely the government entity is going to have knowledge to trigger the gross negligence standard. Typically, in the many, many cases involving natural conditions in a park, one thing that makes it different is if you have a condition that's open and obvious, there's not a case. If the condition is not open and obvious, many times the government entity is not going to have the requisite knowledge for a gross negligence standard, and I'm thinking of the situation in Miranda with the tree branches. So that's one immediate difference.
But does it have to be specific knowledge? In other words, do you have to know about the specific tree branch? Because everybody knows trees do drop branches.
We know it has to be more specific knowledge than knowledge in Miranda that tree branches can drop. So in that sense, absolutely.
So in our situation, if everybody knows that rocks do fall off of cliffs, especially limestone, but even granite, if I recall, the man in the mountain in New Hampshire is no more because the granite man's face fell off, despite the state's best efforts to keep it up there. I mean, rocks fall off of cliffs. Don't you, by the same then, wouldn't you have to have known this specific rocks would have fallen off? Because otherwise, if it's just general, do you know rocks can fall off, trees can drop? You always know that.
I'm not exactly sure where you draw the line, but I think we're on the right side of the line in this case. It does need to be a certain level of specific knowledge. Here what we have is that Rodesky report, and does that Rodesky report say this very rock that collapsed under Brett? No, it doesn't. But I don't believe that's necessary for the gross negligence standard. What we have is a very extensive description of the many structural defects that can not only cause rocks to come away in smaller chunks or pebbles or even fist-sized chunks, but there's described a plain wedge fault where all kinds of cubic yards of rock can come tumbling down. And the specific knowledge that the cliffs with this geologic structure, limestone geologic structure, that have these faults, and I think there's about three different types of faults described, that would be specific enough knowledge that there is that type of risk, that that's not expected. I mean, rock coming down in that kind of volume is a very different matter than rocks cracking away from the edge of the cliff. So,
on that subject.
Yes, Your Honor.
In regards to the objective prong of gross negligence, there's quite a bit of evidence here about the risk of injury if the rocks fall.
Yes, Your Honor.
What evidence is there of the risk that the rocks will fall? Is there any probability assigned to that, or anything in the record that indicates that this is going to happen regularly, rarely, routinely, anything?
Yes, Your Honor, there is. The Radusky report says that due to one of these faults, the plain wedge fault, that there is a hazard for large volumes of rock threatening to come down at any time. And so the report...
What does that mean? It's going to happen daily, or there's a 50% chance, or...
There are no measures like that, Your Honor. There are no percentages, or there are no time periods daily or weekly. But I think what the report makes clear is that this is an ongoing hazard that at any time could pose serious...
Well, I understand, but so are earthquakes in California, but they haven't happened yet, and people haven't moved away. And I'm just wondering, is it like that, where, yes, these structures are unstable and over time they might fall, or is it something like it's impending?
I believe it's different than the recurring danger cases. I believe the city cited the Danan and Thompson cases, and the earthquake's another example. The earthquake happens, and until it's happening again, there's no permanently present risk until the earthquake happens again. Or in Danan and Thompson, I think we had an airport with a foot plate that they'd screw it down, it'd be safe. At some point, it would come loose, but it's not always presenting a risk of a hazard, and that only happens recurringly. I think what the Radusky report tells us very urgently is that that risk is omnipresent. It doesn't make a prediction about how often the rocks will actually fall, but as for the risk, that's always there and doesn't come and go away as the footplates in the airport or an earthquake, Your Honor. And so... in the interpretation of Shoemake, in addition to the city's position imposing the type of limitation on gross negligence that this court rejected and said couldn't be done, I believe the discussion about natural conditions is framed pretty clearly by the court when it says, in the middle of that section, a landowner has no duty to warn or protect trespassers from obvious defects or conditions. Thus, the owner may assume that the user needs no warning to appreciate the dangers of natural conditions. I think putting the core holding of Shoemake together with that, what we understand is there are going to be no duty to warn of the open and obvious conditions of nature, and there's examples of natural conditions, but that the core holding of Shoemake tells us that an absolute prohibition on natural conditions, what the city's arguing for is a limitation that would say, let's stipulate there's gross negligence. We all agree it's not open and obvious. We all agree that there's horrendous gross negligence. Still, no claim as a matter of law, and that's contrary to the Cole
report. The report came in 95, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
In the last 13, 14 years, is Mr. McGeehee's death the one and only falling rock-related injury or death that's occurred at Cameron Park?
No, it's not, Your Honor. In Captain Samaripa's deposition, he mentioned that there had been six others to his knowledge. It's not clear from the record what the timing of all of them were. I think the majority of them have been since the report, although the record leaves open the possibility that one happened before.
Only one of those deaths, though, was from rock collapsing beneath the feet of the visitor to the park, though. The other were from rocks falling on the persons, right?
Actually, Your Honor, what the record says is that Captain Samaripa testified that Brad McGeehee's death was the only one he knew about in which the large volumes of rock collapsed, and the others were slips or falls, if we're talking about from the top of the cliff. And very briefly, the argument about applying the discretionary acts immunity. The city is relying on highway cases where what this court held is that the decision to design highways and public works was a discretionary act. That's very different than what we have here, the adequacy of the warning about this kind of condition. And that is not a discretionary act for a couple different reasons. First of all, there's a specific legal duty here from the recreational use statute that says you have to warn or make safe a gross negligence duty. I see that my time's up. May I finish that thought? Or?
You may finish your thought.
Thank you. And because there is a specific legal duty imposed here by its own textual terms, 101-056 does not apply.
Are there any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Olson, if this is true that six other individuals were killed in that area because of some faulty rock formation, does that now become a known danger and create some duty?
Well, it wasn't because of a faulty rock formation. In fact, the evidence is just the opposite.
And what if it had been? What if there had been many of these throughout the park and even in this specific area?
We have a park with a cliff that is as open and obvious as any sheer cliff I think this court would have had in mind when it wrote this opinion. There was a 4-foot wall in place. There were two signs, not one, but two big signs. They're in the record. For your safety, do not go beyond this wall. In this situation, if there had been more than one fall here, I'd be asking the court, I don't know how much further we'd be required to go. There are two signs that people of reasonable intelligence, we believe, would read and say, for your safety, don't go climbing over this wall. The conclusion as to why should be obvious. It's a 70-foot cliff. The fractured limestone is obvious. The rocks on the ground are obvious. The danger is obvious. So I would say, too, in this situation, short of Justice Brister's question about fencing off the entire park, this is not just a cliff in a limited area. This is a line of cliffs. This is the Balcones Escarpment. So I would say to Your Honor, we've had the wall, we had the signs. I don't know how much more the city could do reasonably, especially in light of the open and obvious risk posed by any cliff. Justice Wainwright, may I respond to the question that you posed to the state just a moment ago as to where in the statute we find this, because I had the same question. And I'll have to admit to you that prior to Shoemake, I understood Chapter 75 to mean that there was no duty owed to a person who come on property because of the trespasser standard. So when I was, and in that regard, 75002D, which is the section that says that A, B, and C shall not limit the liability of an owner of real property who has been grossly negligent or has acted with malicious intent or bad faith. I had understood that to mean negligent activity, because you can't be grossly negligent if you didn't do something. In this situation, when I read that what the court has done in Shoemake was to say that in order for there to be a liability, there must be gross negligence in the creation of the condition. That made sense to me, because under 75002D, the legislature has said one must be grossly negligent. The city of Waco was not grossly negligent in creating Cameron Park and Circle Point Cliff. So it the logic to me, Justice Wainwright, was in 75002D, I understand that requires action. I understood it to require activity until Shoemake came down. It makes sense to me, your ruling in Shoemake, that requires that there be activity to create the dangerous condition. So that's how I understand the difference between the requirement that it be created through gross negligence and the natural condition.
I see. Counsel, can you think of any natural conditions where there's a duty of the governmental entity to do something, warn or make it safe?
I would have to say I'm reading the court's words. And when I read here...
I'm taking you outside of the court's words.
Okay.
We get these cases, and it's important to get it right
for
the parties here. But what we write applies to every situation like this that's going to happen in Texas in the future. So I'm talking big picture.
Can you think
of any natural conditions where a duty would arise?
My response to you, I think, Your Honor, is I think the legislature has made that decision. I think, again, before Shoemake, I understood the legislature to have said there is no duty owed in a premises defect in premises condition claim in a recreational use setting because of the trespasser standard. Whether I agree with it, don't agree with it, I think the legislature made that call.
For natural conditions.
For any condition. That's how I understood it before Shoemake.
Is the sign today as it was then?
Sir?
Are the warnings today as they were then?
Waco passed a big bond issue, and a bunch of work is being done all over the park, as well as the convention center and everything else. To be honest with you, Your Honor, I don't know. I don't know that. If there's a change, it's because of the passage of the bond issue and the work that's being done. We would ask that the court reverse the Court of Appeals, affirm the trial court, and dismiss the case.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Olson. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.